Tonight, this is a sort of a different thing than I've done. I often do. Usually, I'll take a particular sutta or section of the sutta and talk about that. In a way, I'm doing that. Essentially, in the Samyutta Nikaya, there are sections on various themes, and the two main ones I'm drawing from. The theme seems to be advice on practicing. One section is even called Connected Discourses on the Path. It's sort of an interesting mixture of things, and I just wanted to share them all. You can see my book, I got all these tabs in them. There's like so many, I have to find the right one. Oh, there it is, there's the number one there. And this is, those of you who like to record and write down these things, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya 56:38. Bhikkhus, so long as the sun and moon have not risen in the world, for just so long there's no manifestation of great light and radiance. But then blinding darkness prevails, a dense mass of darkness. For just so long day and night are not discerned, the month and fortnight are not discerned, the seasons and the year are not discerned. So he said, without the radiance of the sun and the moon, it would be in the dark all the time. But bhikkhus, when the sun and moon arise in the world, then there's the manifestation of great light and radiance. There is no blinding darkness, no dense mass of darkness. Then day and night are discerned, the month and fortnight are discerned, the seasons and the years are discerned. So too, bhikkhus, so long as a Tathagata has not arisen in the world, a Tathagata is an enlightened being, an Arhant, a perfected enlightened one, for just so long there's no manifestation of great light and radiance, but then blinding darkness prevails. So when there isn't a great teacher having arisen, he's saying that the world is lost in darkness, essentially, right? But because when a Tathagata arises in the world, an Arhant, a perfected enlightened one, then there is this manifestation of great light and radiance. Then there is the explaining, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, disclosing, analyzing, and elucidating of the Four Noble Truths. What four? The noble truth of suffering, and he lists the Four Noble Truths. And so he's actually comparing himself to the sun rising. Though he's not in any way, because he's saying, when is any great being like him has arisen, that's when the light shines in the world and people can learn things. And so, in a sense, he's pointing to the need for gratitude. That we should be have gratitude that the Buddha actually existed, that he actually arose and the sun rose and there was this light that we could see. This is, we're trying to see things clearly. In the dark, it's pretty hard to see things clearly. It's an interesting image, I thought, that I sort of liked. So then, there's this other verse. And this is, once again, the Samyutta Nikaya 56:11. Setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma is called. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling in Varanasi. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. So the group of five were the five original disciples of the Buddha. Because these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And what, because is the middle way awakened to by the Tathagata? What has given him vision? What leads to nibbana? It is the Noble Eightfold Path. So here is an actual expression of that phrase we use all the time, where the Buddha teaches the middle way. And he's actually giving two extremes. He's, that from his own life, living in luxury, he lived in, you know, as a prince in a palace, and had, you know, everything he could possibly imagine. His father just wanted to make sure he got everything he could ever use. And then later on in his practice life, he practiced very intense self-mortification. There are things in the Samyutta Nikaya where they're describing he's, you know, living on one grain of rice a day and nothing but nettle soup. Extreme things, right? And you're saying neither of those work. You have to find the middle way, which is what he has described in the Eightfold Path. So here's just like an announcement of the middle way, in a sense. Then we go on. This is actually a famous image he uses. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya 47.19. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sambhas. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, once in the past, an acrobat set up his bamboo pole and addressed his apprentice thus, 'Come, climb the bamboo pole and stand on my shoulders.' Having replied, 'Yes, teacher,' the apprentice climbed up the bamboo pole and stood on the teacher's shoulders. The acrobat then said to the apprentice, 'You protect me, and I'll protect you.' Thus guarded by one another, protected by one another, we'll display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole." When this was said, the apprentice replied, "That's not the way to do it, teacher. You protect yourself, teacher, and I'll protect myself. Thus, each self-guarded and self-protected will display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole." "That's the method there," the Blessed One said. "It's just as the apprentice said to the teacher, 'I'll protect myself, because thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. I will protect others, bhikkhus. Thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced.' Protecting oneself, bhikkhus, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself." So, what does he mean by protecting? And basically, he means not losing yourself in worldly things, and actually keeping the precepts. And by doing this, by actually leading a virtuous life, you protect others. You help them stick to the path as well, both by being an example and literally by creating an energetic field that people feel. If you've ever been around someone who's really pure and deep in the practice, there's a certain energy in the room that just you notice. As soon as you walk into the room, they go, "Oh, there's something different here." And how do you do this? How do you protect yourself? By mindfully making choices in your day-to-day life. That's all we have to do, is just make choices in our daily life. And I forgot to grab one of these books. This is a great poem that I love that describes this idea of protecting yourself. This is from Naomi Shihab Nye's book, Words Under the Words, and it's called The Art of Disappearing. Some of you may have heard me read this before. But when they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. He'll never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. I love that last image. Walk around feeling like a leaf, though you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. This is like she's pointing to, and the Buddha's pointing to, this idea that we have to understand that we only have a limited time. Right now we have ideal conditions. So here we are all hanging out together, studying the Dhamma. Who knows how long these conditions are going to last. We don't know. And so it's important that we understand that. And that we, as she said, do we have to guard our energy? Not let ourselves get pulled into situations that it might be harmful, but more like just like irrelevant to the practice. They're just like ways that we fritter away time, essentially. Not that frittering away time sometimes might be useful. It's like everyone's all we need to just sort of kick back and relax, right? I'm not saying we should never do that. I have a note here. There's an example of, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up, right? Or actually Labor Day. Some families get together on Labor Day too. And you all, you know, you get together with the family, and there's always, you know, that weird uncle who is going to, you know, spend half the day talking to you about XYZ that are just like, from your point of view, total nonsense. And you're going to go, "Oh God, why did I come to this party?" And you can't sort of pause and say, no, you know, that what you're saying is total nonsense. That never works anyway. You'll just go off on a different tangent, right? It could be a weird aunt, not a weird uncle, by the way. It doesn't necessarily have to be an uncle. I had an uncle who was somewhat odd, so I think of that one as an example. So it's just like, it's great to get together with the family. It's really wonderful, and it can be very sort of, you make you feel good. And I'm not saying you shouldn't get together with your family, but maybe sort of show up late and leave early. You know? We're going to get together for the whole weekend. Well, I can only come on Sunday for the day. You know, this sort of limit yourself so you have more time to not get caught up in that dynamic. And not all families are like that. Sometimes getting together with family, I know, is just absolutely sweet. So I'm not saying family is bad or anything like that either. Just be aware of situations where you just know you're going to go, "Oh God, what am I doing here?" halfway through, or maybe even not halfway through. Then there's this really interesting sutta. This is actually the next sutta in the book. And it's called Interestingly enough, the most beautiful girl in the land. Vim Vasura, the bhikkhus, replied. The Blessed One said thus, Bhikkhu, suppose that on hearing the most beautiful girl of the land, the most beautiful girl of the land, a great crowd of people would assemble. Now that most beautiful girl of the land would dance exquisitely and sing exquisitely. On hearing, the most beautiful girl of the land is dancing, the most beautiful girl of the land is singing, an even larger crowd of people would assemble. Then a man would come along, wishing to live, not wishing to die, wishing for happiness, averse to suffering. Some would say to him, Good man, you must carry around this bowl of oil filled to the brim between the crowd and the most beautiful girl of the land. A man with a drawn sword will follow right behind you, and wherever you spill even a little of it, right then he'll chop off your head. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that man stop attending to that bowl of oil and out of negligence turn his attention outwards? I mean, this is kind of interesting. It's sort of a dramatic example, but it's like, this is how serious you have to take the practice. You know, you can't get distracted by the beautiful girls, those things that distract us. He's just using this one because it's culturally appropriate, but probably not so culturally appropriate now. But it's like, we have to be diligent. We can't just let things slide. And there's this one talking about being diligent, right? Bhikkhus, if one's clothes or head were ablaze, what should be done about it? Your head's on fire. Venerable Sir, if one's clothes or head were ablaze, to extinguish one's blazing clothes or head, one should arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. Bhikkhus, one might look on equanimously at one's blazing clothes or head, paying no attention to them, but so long as one has not made the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths, as they really are, in order to make the breakthrough, one should arouse extraordinary desire, make an effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm. So he's saying, you should practice like your hair is on fire. Which I just like, with another one, just yet another interesting image. Like, and some of us don't have much hair, so it's probably going to be hard to imagine our hair on fire, but maybe our whole head's on fire, whatever. It's just like, once again, he's pointing to how serious you need to take the practice. We practice diligently, you know, as it, with we stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. So he's encouraging taking the practice seriously by this image. Then there's this really sort of changing the topic in a sense. So this is on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in Raja Gaha, in the bamboo grove. The Brahmin, of course, it's always a Brahmin. He was known as Bharadvaja, the abusive. Heard, it is said that the Brahmin of the Bharadvajakan has gone forth from the household into homelessness under the aesthetic Gautama. In other words, someone who should be following him has gone to practice with the Buddha instead. Angry and displeased, he approached the Blessed One and abused and reviled him with rude, harsh words. When he had finished speaking, the Blessed One said to him, "What do you think, Brahman? Do your friends and colleagues, kinsmen and relatives, as well as guests, come to visit you?" He's changing the topic in a sense, right? "Sometimes they come to visit Master Gotama. Do you then offer them food or a meal or a snack?" "Sometimes I do, Master Gotama." "But if they do not accept it from you, then to whom does the food belong?" "If they do not accept it from me, then the food still belongs to me." "So too, Brahman, we do not abuse anyone. We do not scold anyone. We do not rail against anyone. We refuse to accept from you the abuse and scolding and tirade you let loose at us. It still belongs to you, Brahman. It still belongs to you, Brahman. Brahman, one who abuses his own abuser, who scolds the one who scolds him, who rails against the one who rails against them, he is said to partake of the meal, to enter upon an exchange. We do not partake of your meal. We do not enter upon an exchange. It still belongs to you, Brahman. It still belongs to you." This is like this brilliant idea about how to deal with people who, you know, come and diss you in a variety of ways. Because the impulse is always to sort of diss them back, you know, to get them back, to that sort of urge to get them in some way. And he's saying, no, just don't take what's offered. It's like if you don't take it, if you don't take it in, if you don't make it, give it any attention, if you just let it slide by, then what can that other person do? They're just stuck. They're the one who's riled up, and they're the one who's suffering. They're suffering because they're riled up and angry and full of hate. So what? It doesn't affect you unless you let it affect you. Unless you feel you have to do something about what this person is saying to you or acting, how this person is acting towards you. And this is a choice. This is a clear-cut choice that we can make, that we, if we don't take it, then we're not abused anymore. We're only abused if we take it. Otherwise, you just let it be. Let it slide by. I think it's very brilliant, everyday, worldly advice. Because we all get into situations where someone's ranting at us about something or other. And we just have to sort of go, okay, I'm just not going to take that. I'm not going to take that abuse. Not like in an angry way, not in any forceful way. Just let it go. Because then it's not yours. It has nothing to do with you. It just has to do with this other person being in this bad mood. Feeling they have the right to straighten you out, which is often what's going on with things like this. And another thing we have to remember, because this is sort of, this particular sutta is more like the in the world advice, right? Is that it's okay to have worldly possessions. It's okay to have stuff. You just have to have the right attitude towards them. Right? And there's this book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula, who was a monastic, I think it's from like Czechoslovakia or something. He went and lived in Sri Lanka for a while and was a monastic and then came back and wrote this book. And he's sort of like, this is like an all-in-one thin book, a summary of all of the Buddha's major teachings. Interesting in some ways. This is a story about householder life. Once the Buddha told Anathapindika, the great banker, one of his most devoted lay disciples, who founded for him the celebrated Jetavana Monastery, that a layman who leads an ordinary family life has four kinds of happiness. So this is us. These are the four kinds of happiness. The first happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. So it's okay to have a job and make money and, you know, do things. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends, and relatives, on on meritorious deeds. So it's okay to not only make money but spend it. Lead a happy life, but make sure you use some of that wealth to help others. To give Donna in a variety of ways to be useful in the world, like this. And that the Pindaka who built this entire monastery for the Buddhist monks. The third, be free from debt. When I first read this, it was like, oh, be free from debt. What an interesting thing for the Buddha to talk about. But you know, when you think about being in debt, then you always have to worry about it. Oh, you know, am I going to keep my job? Am I going to have an, you know, can I, you know, I can't do that because I got to put that money away to pay off that debt. You know, it's a mental thing that goes on and on and on until you pay off the debt. And I'm not saying you should never go into debt. If you live in our culture and you want to own a house, you pretty much, unless you're fabulously wealthy or have fabulously wealthy friends who give you a bunch of money, you have to sort of go into debt, right? Or buy a car these days even. Most car prices are like $30,000, $35,000 now. It's like shocking. So then you just have to be very conscious of, I got to get out of this as soon as I can. And I'm speaking from personal experience here because I, you know, like everybody else, I had a young family and I had a mortgage for this house I lived in with my family, and some friends came to live with us and helped, you know, defray the cost of the mortgage. But it was like a 20-year mortgage. I would think, God, 20 years, I got to keep paying this thing. I have to keep this job, which was okay jobbing, but it was still a job, and I had to go there, and it was hard, got a lot of work. And I did everything I could to pay off that debt. I actually paid off my 20-year mortgage in 11 years. And the day I paid off that mortgage, it was like such a feeling of relief, because then I all of a sudden I had this choice. Oh, I could choose to do this, I could choose to do that. I don't have to keep working this hard anymore. I actually went to arrange my life so I had it for a while. I had a half-time job. And then eventually I became a Dharma teacher, and then who knows, I'm just an unemployed bum now anyway. So, but it's a really amazing thing to be debt-free. It just makes your life open. And I just find it interesting that the Buddha would mention that among the four things that cause happiness. And then the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life, or is to live a life of virtue. The bliss of blamelessness, the Buddha would talk about. So, this is how to lead the life of a householder. This is how we need to lead our lives. We need to be, it's okay to make money, it's okay to have income and make money and do things, as long as how you're doing it is virtuous. It's okay to spend the money, you go to a nice restaurant and have a good time and do all those things people do. It's not like you have to live, you know, we have this sort of thing, oh, I'm going to be a good Buddhist, I'm going to live like a pauper, you know. Not do anything. No, it's okay. It's okay. Just make sure that some of that wealth you have goes to others who have less. Take care of the rest of the people in the world who have been, for some reason, less fortunate than you. Then have no debt and lead a virtuous life. Quite a good formula for happiness as far as I'm concerned. And then this. I find this one interesting too. This is Samyutta Nikaya 16:12, for those of you who keep track. It's called After Death. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahakasapa and the Venerable Sariputta, this is two of the Buddha's most senior disciples, were dwelling at Varanasi. Then in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion and approached the Venerable Mahakasapa. He exchanged greetings, and they concluded the greetings. He sat down to one side and said to him, "How is it, friend Kasapa? Does the Tathagata exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata exists after death." "Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. The Tathagata does not exist after death." "How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death?" It's the classic, trying to cover all the angles, right? "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death." "Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death?" And it was the double negative, right? "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either." Why hasn't the Blessed One declared this, friend? Like, so he's getting frustrated. No matter what I say about the Tathagata after death, he doesn't say anything. "Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment." In other words, this is useless to speculate about this. Why are you bothering to think about this at all, when you could be thinking about something useful, when you could be practicing instead? And so then he says, therefore the Blessed One has not declared this, because it isn't useful. "And what, friend, has the Blessed One declared?" "The Blessed One has declared, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering." "And why, friend, has the Blessed One declared this?" "Because, friend, this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and leads to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, etc." In other words, pay attention. Here's the Four Noble Truths. Think about this. Don't try and figure out what happens after death. It's not beneficial. And there's actually, in other places in the sutra, you'll see other things where the Buddha says, you know, how did the universe begin and how is the universe going to end? You know, and there's other ones like this that he says, don't, these are all like speculative, philosophical, and you can't ever really know the truth, the answer. So why are you bothering to think about it? Because it's kind of interesting, and you can sort of sound wise. Right? I've got it figured out. I understand how the universe is going to end in my wise philosophy. This is a lot of what Western philosophy has got involved in over the years. It's like trying to come up with definitive answers to these sort of unanswerable questions. And the Buddha kept saying, no, 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 don't bother with this stuff. It's not useful. It's not beneficial. And this is another piece of sutta. I forget where I found this, but I've had it sort of stashed away for a long time. This is the Buddha talking. The Buddha is near the end of his life. "I am now grown old, Ananda, and full of years. My journey is drawing to a close. I've reached the sum of my days. I'm turning 80 years of age," which in that was that day and age, for someone to live to 80 was like really rare. Just as the worn-out cart cannot be made to move along without much difficulty, so the body of the Tathagata can only be kept going with much additional care. It's actually time when my body's falling apart and is worn out. It is only when the Tathagata Ananda, ceasing to attend to any outward thing, becomes plunged in that devout meditation of heart, which is concerned with no bodily object, it is only then that the body of the Tathagata is at ease. Only when I go into very deep states of meditation where the body disappears, that's when I'm not caught up in the physical suffering that is involved in just having an old body. Therefore, Ananda, this is what's happening, my body's worn out. Therefore, Ananda, be you lamps unto yourselves, rely on yourselves, and do not rely on external help. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp. Seek salvation alone in the truth, and look not for any assistance to anyone besides yourselves. So this is, once again, a very famous line from the sutta. And the Buddha is basically saying, no one can do this for you. You have to do this yourself. You have to be your own light. You have to be the lamp unto yourself. The light that you're seeking is right there in you. It's there anyway. So now you just have to tune into that. Don't think you can find some magic external source. And he's saying this because he knows his disciples, his followers, are all quite distressed because he's going to pass and they're all going, oh, what are we going to do without the Tathagata? You know, what are we going to do when he's gone? And he's saying, no, you don't need me anyway. Be a light unto yourself. Just follow the teachings that I've taught you. Be a light unto yourself. But then, it's really interesting, like no one, you gotta do it yourself, you can't depend on anyone else, right? But then he says this. The Venerable Nanda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the noble eightfold path. So he's saying, be a lamp unto yourself, and at the same time he's saying, Sangha is absolutely important. And they seem contradictory, but they're not. Like, Sangha, having, as he says, a good companion leads you to cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. Having Sangha is essential to this practice. I mean, it's really difficult to do this practice all by yourself. Having a group of people of like mind who you're connected to at the heart level, who are also working themselves, being their own lights, but we sort of, our lights reflect on each other in some sense. And it really is helpful to have that connection to others, to be able to have the support of Sangha. It's essential. It's not half of the holy life, it's the whole holy life. That's why what we're doing right here, right now, is so important. It's like having this connection, and the sharing of the Dhamma, having other people of like mind and heart that you're connected to is essential to the practice. Even though in the end you have to do it all by yourself, you have this sort of energetic field around you that helps you stick with the practice and sticks with going forward. It's an interesting life. All of the holy life comes from solitude. There's, of course, a piece of poetry I love that supports this. This is from Dana Fall's book, Sangha, it's called. It's from her book, Poems from the Heart of Yoga, Go In and In. And this poem is called Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fire in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. That's what Sangha gives us. That's the importance of Sangha in poetic form.